Chapter 1. The Present. When I was 17, I'd slept in a cave for 15 years. I was 17 for a very long time, and I missed that cave. I had walked from Jaipur to New Delhi, and from there to Kathmandu, sleeping in deep trenches along the side of the dusty road when the sun was up and scorching the desiccated earth. It hadn't rained since I arrived, and my lips were dry and chapped. I was glad I had nobody to talk to, because when I opened my mouth, my lips would crack and sting. If I passed somebody at night, when the moon was high and the sound of crickets and katydids droned across the quiet landscape, I'd keep my head low and offer them a humble greeting. "Namaste," they'd say, and they'd marvel at the white teenager with a t-shirt over his head. "Very nice eyes," they'd tell me. People don't remember my face. It's my eyes that capture them. I suppose that's a good thing. In Kathmandu, a farmer let me ride in the back of his tempo van among crates of underweight chickens and a single goat that stared at me as if he was reading my mind. I'd eaten goats before, and I think he knew that. The farmer dropped me as close to the Tibetan border as he could and pumped his sharp horn as he drove away. He gave me a chicken as a gift. "For luck," he'd said. And as we watched him turn down the dusty road in the blue darkness of early morning, I called the chicken Georgie and said, "Shall we go?" Georgie clucked her agreement, and we crossed the border among the morbidly barren Himalayan foothills, under a navy sky dotted with more stars than I'd ever seen. In the east, the horizon was turning gray. I zigzagged from the foothills into the mountains, Georgie trapped under one arm, using my free hand for support when the cliffs got too steep to walk on. I had a lifetime of pain to hide, and when I found a cave whose mouth was open against the northern wind, I ventured inside, slowly, a torch flashing in front of me. I stomped my feet and cawed like a bird. Were there leopards in the Himalayas, or jackals? I wasn't sure, but the cave was empty, so I unpacked my travel case, a thin sleeping bag, and a handful of soil from home that I'd carried with me for years. I pressed my fingers into that soil, tasting a grain of it to remind myself why I was there 5,000 meters above sea level, surrounded by a thick wind and the thin air and a blanket of snow beyond the cave's entrance. I tied a piece of twine around Georgie's leg and trapped the other end under a rock so she couldn't escape, though I knew she wanted to. Everybody leaves me. They always do. I sat on the sleeping bag and folded my hands in my lap, and I spoke to Georgie partly in English, partly in Vietnamese, which I'd been learning recently, and Georgie wobbled her head like she was objecting to my story. When I grew tired of her incessant clucking, I said, "Sorry, Georgie." I caught the twine, pulled her to me, and stroked her small head. She turned away from me like she knew what was coming. Her eyes were as orange as her feathers. She fussed in my arms until I held her tighter and soothed her with gentle noises. And then I ate her. When I was done, I wrapped what was left of her in an age-worn Nirvana t-shirt and built a small cairn over her remains, just outside the entrance of my cave where I could see it. I crossed my legs on the sleeping bag, stared out at the distant peaks, and watched as the sunlight shifted across the earth, falling inside the cave's opening but never outstaying its welcome. Day became night became day. I stopped counting after 237 days, or was it 238? During my third winter, a fierce wind knocked over Georgie's cairn, and I imagined I heard her clucking in the days while I watched the driving snow. "Are you back?" I asked. But the noise of her stopped, and I was alone. When I came down from the mountains, I was a new man, and I was 17. I walked back to Kathmandu, bought a plane ticket to Dublin via London, and from there I walked through the late summer nights towards County Clare and the coastal village I once called home. As I walked alongside the empty football field, up Comer Street, past the old apple orchard whose walls were crumbling, I didn't feel tired. I was renewed. 15 years in a cave might drive a man to insanity, or it might make an insane man sane. You decide. I gathered up the money I'd been saving over the years and made a few calls. And 2 months later, I stood outside Lakeshore Manor Nursing Home under a waning moon that was hidden somewhere behind the building. Death was in the air. I smelled him. I rang the bell, and when the door opened, Mrs. Conway filled the frame like death's advisor. I mumbled my name and she folded her arms, her silhouette swelling as though she could block out more than just the light. "You're late," she said, her tone as cold as the frigid air. I smiled. She wouldn't have wanted me there any earlier. She leaned forward, her face emerging from shadow, narrow eyes sunk deep into puffy cheeks, a broad nose casting a shadow over thin, stern lips. How old are you? When I'd sent her my application, I'd fudged my date of birth. I'm 20, I lied. You look 14. Mrs. Conway's voice was dark with suspicion. Good genes, I said. Trust me, when I'm 100, they'll still be asking for my ID. She grunted, the sound like wet gravel underfoot, and stepped aside as warm orange light spilled out past her swollen ankles. When I didn't move from the steps, I heard the impatience in her voice. You're letting the heat out, come in. I stepped over the threshold onto the pale blue tiles. An overhead heater pushed fingers of warm air through my hair, and a hum of electricity buzzed inside the walls. The reception desk, unmanned at this time of night, had a thin computer monitor with the nursing home's logo sliding around the screen. I was sure the computer was as old as some of the residents. Mrs. Conway walked ahead of me without a word. In her office, she closed the door and sat behind her desk with a sigh, like the exhalation of a dying soul. I couldn't tell how old she was. In her 50s, no doubt, maybe 60. She adjusted her thick glasses, and the swivel chair groaned beneath her. She opened a drawer, pulled out a roll of stickers, and wrote my name on one, tearing it from the roll with careless fingers. It's only temporary until we get you a name badge, she said. Then added, you don't look like a Victor. What does a Victor look like? I asked, peeling the sticker from its backing and patting it to my shirt like I was at a speed dating event. We'd had a series of phone interviews where she'd quizzed me on aspects of a night porter's role and the experience I'd claimed to have. I'd nursed people through death before, but never in a formal setting. Not in a care home. It's not much more than minimum wage, she'd told me, and I'd laughed and said the money was fine. It's a lonely job, she'd said. You could go the whole night without seeing a soul. I thrive in my own company, I'd told her. Because people suck. But I didn't add that part. 15 years in a cave has you second-guessing your words before you speak. Now, she pushed a sheet of paper across her desk. This is a list of duties that you should check off every night. When I leave in... She checked her watch, a dainty thing that looked out of place on her thick, freckled wrist. 20 minutes. I will hand you a set of keys for the front and back door, but you should only use them in an emergency. Do I make myself clear? What did she think I was going to do? Throw a party? Yes, ma'am, I said. She clasped her hands together on the desk and studied my thin face. Are you sure you're 20? I smiled, again. You flatter me, Mrs. Conway, trust me. Some days I feel like I'm 92. Her nod told me she felt the same. Gloria is the duty nurse tonight. She'll look after you for the first few shifts, make sure you're settling in. Most of the residents are already in bed, but there are some wily ones that will try to sneak out before the doors are locked. There's a spare dressing gown on each floor. Mr. Buckley is fond of gallivanting around in the buff after dark, and that's not a sight for the faint of heart. And if they ask you for food, don't feed them. Like the Mogwai, I said. Excuse me? Gremlins. Do not feed them after midnight, and whatever you do, don't get them wet. She narrowed her eyes. I watch a lot of old movies, I told her. Please don't get my residents wet, she said. I'll try my best. She wasn't amused. Do you believe in ghosts, Victor? She asked. No, I said. I didn't hesitate, but I looked at her. I could smell the garlic potatoes she'd had for dinner, and my stomach churned. Garlic makes me sick. She'd tried to mask it with a cheap perfume, but it wasn't up to the job. She said, I need you to be a ghost. Can you do that for me? Do I need some clanking chains and a white sheet? Wouldn't that shorten the lifespan of the residents? My smile was lost on her. Ghosts are never seen, Victor. If a porter can get through the night without being seen, he has done a good job, do you understand? I tapped the side of my nose. I excel at not being seen. You won't even know I'm here. Mrs. Conway led me upstairs and introduced me to Gloria Pinto, the duty nurse. She barely looked up from her clipboard long enough to register my presence, but I noticed she had a nice neck. A long, slender one. If you were into that sort of thing. Mrs. Conway didn't have a neck. Her head sat between her shoulders, meaning that her shiny earrings had nowhere to dangle. When she handed me a set of heavy keys, she shrugged herself into a thick wool coat and left. Outside, she tapped on the glass panel of the front door and pointed at the lock. I locked it. When she had left and I heard her car cutting into the night, I looked around the empty foyer. A clock ticked somewhere deep in the bowels of the manor. Somebody was crying themselves to sleep, and a radio was on in the empty kitchen. A fluorescent light blinked twice like it was too weak to stay awake. Behind me, Gloria said, tidy up the entry hall and run through the tasks on your list. I'll be in the office if you need anything. She looked at me. Please don't need anything. She strode through the foyer, disappearing into the back office where the medications were kept, and then, with her arms full, she walked past me with a fine dust of silence behind her. I waved as she went and then sat back in the creaking chair at the reception desk. The crying had stopped and the distant radio played a soothing ballad. It was 10 p.m. and the rest of the night was mine. I liked this time of night the best. An hour or two after dark, with the sun below the horizon and the moon still weak, and an early autumn breeze pushing languid leaves around outside. I hadn't lied to Mrs. Conway. I'd learned to enjoy my own company. I'd needed to. Georgie could have told you that. I used to talk to myself, I told the empty foyer. But not anymore. I checked my list of tasks and the phone rang once before I went upstairs. But when I answered it, there was nobody there. Maybe it was death checking up on me. I slipped up to the next floor, and when I stood in the corridor surrounded by heavy wooden doors, I closed my eyes and inhaled. Death was close. I could smell him. When I sniffed the air, I knew he was 2 days out, maybe three. I spread my arms and touched the bedroom doors as I moved down the corridor until I felt Death's energy sizzling in the air like a current of dark fear. I stopped. The label on the door said Agnes O'Shea. I eased it open. As the light spilled inside, the old woman's white hair shone against her pillow. There was barely a rise and fall in her narrow chest. I stood by her bed. Her hands were small, and I could see the veins at her wrists, blue and latticed. Her eyelids fluttered. There was an ache on her face that made her frown, even in her sleep. But she wasn't why I was here. Death was coming, and for Agnes, perhaps it would be a relief. I took one of her hands and felt her pain, drawing it into me. I closed my eyes and let it flood my body. Pain was transformative. It strengthened me, and a smile curled at the corner of her lips as her features softened. Rest easy, I whispered. Death knows you, but when he takes you, I'll be here. I won't let you go alone.
Stephen,
she mumbled in her sleep. I drew the blanket over her hand, still reeling from her dizzying pain in my limbs. I could feel it flushing through my body where blood used to run. In the corridor, I inspected the remaining doors and then went up another flight. I read the names, Alexander Martins, Terry Grimes, Daniel and Joseph McGuire, and opposite their room was the name I'd been looking for, the reason I'd left the desperate comfort of my Himalayan cave. I approached his door, but the lift at the end of the hall pinged and Gloria stepped out. Vincent? She asked. Victor, I reminded her. Victor, have you watered the plants in the common room yet? I moved away from the door and said, I'm just doing my security checks. It's next on my list. She nodded and disappeared into the east wing. I listened to the sound of her soft shoes on the tiled floor and I sniffed the air to see where Death was. At the bedroom door, I opened it, just a crack, enough to let the light in. The old man was asleep in his bed, one hand on his chest, the collar of his pajama shirt cocked at one side, a half-empty jug of water on the nightstand next to a framed photo. His quiet snoring was melodic. I'd heard those snores before, and I smiled. I went inside and closed the door. The shape of him lit the darkened room like a flame that I was drawn to. I lifted the heavy chair from the far wall and moved it beside the bed, easing it down gently. When I sat, I closed my eyes before looking at him. The man in the bed was my heart. I'd be dead without him. I opened my eyes. His nose was bigger now, longer, and his jowls were sunken. But I could never mistake him. I reached out. I wanted to feel his pain, but I stopped myself from touching him, my fingers hovering over his age-blemished hand. My body trembled, and I made a fist, then shook my hand loose. His eyebrows were long, flecked with white, and although his lips were thinner now, paler, they were unmistakable. I leaned over him, and I kissed his forehead. "Hello, James," I whispered. "Did you miss me?" He didn't wake, but as my lips touched the wrinkled skin of his broad brow, I felt some of his pain, just enough to spark a tear of longing behind my tired eyes. I wiped the tears with a finger and touched the wetness of it. It was slick against my skin. I smiled. It had been a long time since I'd cried. And James had been the cause of it then, too.